Hi. My name is not Vital and not Vital. You can imagine I was called in America most of the time. I have been working as a sculptor for exactly half of my life, and as a painter for 22 months. But what I want to talk to you about is a passion that I had when I was 7 or 8 years old. As you know now, that I was born in Switzerland, in the Engadin Valley, which is famous for its beauty, for St. Moritz also. You might know St. Moritz. And also this language, which is my mother language, which is Romansh, only spoken by 36,000 people. And actually the dialect, that my dialect is only spoken by maybe 10,000 people. So growing up there was, when I went to school there, we had 5 months off. We only had to go to school for 7 months, and we had 5 months off. We didn't have to go. And what's happening here? Okay. And during those 5 months, you had to come up to do by doing something interesting, because otherwise you would die of boredom up there. And what was my interest at very early age was to build things, to build huts, to build tree houses. And I remember that later on, when I read Italo Calvino, Il Barone Rampante, Baron on the Tree, it was actually not déjà vu, it was more like a déjà vécu. I already went through that as a child. The most important thing about doing those, building these huts, whatever, was that you did that with enormous passion, which later on you tend to forget, because later on if you start to build things, I mean, it's so complicated, you have to deal with all kinds of codes and whatever. And I was lucky that in 1990, the late of 1990, I went to a place in Africa, in West Africa, called Niger, in a city which is called Agadez. Why I went there, I don't know exactly. I wanted to go to the Sahara Desert, but that's the place I wanted to go. Later on, I remember that I probably had seen one photograph of a mosque of this city. So it was a very long trip. I had to go through Mali, Burkina Faso, and until I arrived to the city of Agadez. I arrived there at night, and early in the morning, I got up, and by that time, they already knew that a white man has arrived there. So they were outside, the Tuaregs were outside trying to sell jewelry to me. And I told them, well, I'm not that interested in jewelry. I would like to have some land or a place that I could build something. And they said, no problem. It's always pas de problème in Africa, because they know what a problem is. And so they showed me this land, which was a little bit outside of the city, in Agadez, in the poorest section of town. And by the way, Niger is the poorest country in the world. And so by 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, the deal was already made. I bought the land, and by 11 o'clock, the first workers came, and we started building. This is how fast it goes. During that time, I did a small drawing how I would like this house to look like. I only had like 2 hours. But like, they looked at it, and they did not understand, because they don't read, they didn't understand my drawing. So I just traced the house where the house should be. I just traced it in the sand. And this is the first house I built. It's called Mecaphonie, which is the house of horns. As you can see, there are so many horns, because the slaughtering house is in the middle of town, and the whole animal is used, but the horns. They don't know what to do with the horns, so they burn them. And so it smells terrible. So I had like this 14-year-old kid who goes every day and collects the horns, and they're all around the house. As you can see, it has three stories. And on the second floor is my room. It has four doors on each direction. I didn't know at the time that when the house when the house was finished, that the workers would leave. It's not like here that when the house is done, the workers leave, of course. There they don't. Because like there's always something to do on the house. It's like a newborn that needs care. And so they're always there. I counted the workers, and they were 55, and they were always there. So like I had to come up with new ideas. It's interesting. It's so interesting that in a country like Niger, the Tuaregs say that what is fast is good, even though they drink tea for 6 hours a day. But they say everything which is fast is good. So I don't have to describe you how the school looked like. It was like I had never seen anything like it. So I decided to make a school, which was so great because I never would have had the opportunity to make a school in Western Europe or America. So because there were so many children, I made a pyramid, and it was planned for 150 children. Unfortunately, because it's on a hill, it attracts too many children. And by 2 years ago, and also last time I was there 2 months ago, there are now four times as many children. So the whole school is full of children. You don't see the schoolhouse anymore. Kids don't go to school, they go on to the school. And so this is kind of like a moving sculpture, which sayings and prayers, and it's really fascinating. It's actually so strong that when I go there, I have like almost tears in my eyes, because it's extremely, extremely a strong environment. And inside, you can see inside, that's where they live during the rainy season. And then I moved north of the city. I got like an oasis. And I built this house against sandstorms and heat. It's tremendously hot there. And this is the house that was done there. This is a house to watch the moon, to watch the stars. And I was just now in New York last week, and I was showing this to someone and saying, like, every day when I'm there, I watch the stars for like 3 hours. And you can imagine from someone in New York, you say, like, you're going crazy, I think. You know, like, how can you spend 3 hours to look at the sky and even build a house for it? The next one was this. This is a house to watch the sunset. If you have ever been to Africa, one of the most fascinating things are sunsets. It actually goes so fast, it's so intense, and since this is in an oasis, I wanted to have a higher elevation where I can look at this frontally for this very, very short time every night. And the tallest stairs leading showing to the west, that's where I sit. That also became my house afterwards. It's very small. It's only 3 by 3 by 3 meters. It has no running water. It has no electricity. But it's one of the most one of the houses I like the most. Now the thing is that while upon its completion, it was something that you cannot. This building is kind of like complete in its sense. There is nothing you can add to it. You cannot take away anything. It's exactly the way it is. And so I decided to move on and build a house to watch the sunset on every continent, because Americans have military bases on every continent. So why not having a house to watch the sunset, like a more poetic approach? I also invited different artists to come and see this, because it was like really, it's a real paradise in this oasis. One of the first people I invited was Richard Long. And we were sitting on top of the stairs watching the sunset, and Richard said to me, "Okay, I'm going to give you the sun." So he made his biggest sculpture ever. It's 30 meters in diameter, made out of, I think, about 8,000 bricks. And this is on the bottom of the house now. The first continent I wanted to build this house was America. I was in Utah, in the desert of Utah, which is fascinating. But then I decided that already things had been built there during land art and the 60s, 70s. So like I went then to South America, to Peru, where I almost find the right spot. But then thanks to an assistant of mine, an architect from Chile, we find this island in Patagonia. And this is the island. It's made out of marble. And these are these caves that you can go in to drive in or walk into it. Now, I was then confronted with something new. I mean, it's so beautiful that you cannot build anything on top of it. And since I'm not an architect, I have the freedom not to build. So I decided then to dig a tunnel inside. So in the last 5 years, we have been working with, I don't know, 5-6 people or even more, digging a tunnel into this mountain on the island, and it's all white marble, okay? They're very good at it, because like in that part of Patagonia, the people, there are so many miners, you say, people who mine, like gold mines and copper mines. So they're very, very good in like digging a hole. And I never knew that you can actually, with explosives, being quite precise. And this is inside this house. So this, you see, like this is the entrance, turns, and you have a cupola, and then a small window towards the west where you can see the sunset. And it's spectacular. This is the house at night. If you can see something, you only see this light, and that's like the house inside the mountain, the island. The island did not have a name because the land, Chile, is so big that most mountains don't have names. Only the big glaciers have names, and so this island didn't have a name. And the people living there before were called Ona. They were naked people. They lived under in very, very harsh circumstances. They lived naked. And they were the Ona. And so I put my name and Ona, so it's now Notona Island. And then for Europe, it's... I don't know if it's going to work out yet, but it's in Norway, in front of the museum in Stavanger, on the lake. And this building would be then in cement. And for China, I mean for Asia, it's going to be in the southern part of Asia, of China, in Guilin, Yangtze. You probably know this from paintings, right? These mountains in Guilin, in Yangtze, also a spectacular place. Then at the same time, I also did things in Switzerland, outside of this little town that you know, I could acquire a park in at the end of this last century, 1998, and it was. The reason I wanted this is to see what kind of outdoor sculptures you can make. It's usually very difficult because you're usually the loser. If you make a sculpture which is 10 meters tall and the tree is 15, so you're usually always losing. So like I approach this a bit different. This is a house that disappears by remote control. Okay, on the left you don't see anything, the middle comes out, And it disappears again. I mean, you can really live in. Would be a great house for Gaddafi now or someone like that. And the reason also why I did this is because like so many people come to this valley of the Engadine, they build this the houses that are only used 5 weeks out of the year. They are imitations of this great architecture of the Engadine, which is one of the most intelligent architecture in the Alps, which also Le Corbusier also studied, and Norman Foster is living there, so he came many times to look at this. So like I could see in his eyes, like, oh my God, this is really irritating. Like here comes like the artist and does something like that. And it's interesting to see like how the gap between architecture and sculpture is so close, right? I mean, it's like, let's say, like Gaudi. What kind of sculpture would you put in front of a house of Gaudi It's not like in the 60s, let's say in New York, where they used to build banks on Wall Street, which has a piazza in front to put the calder or whatever. You know, that's a place to put the sculpture. Now you don't have that anymore. In Beijing, for example, if you see the building of Rem Koolhaas' CCTV, it's a sculpture in itself already. Like houses don't go up straight; they go up crooked. The house by Hauser and Wirth. Demeron. The bird nest. It's a sculpture in itself. You cannot imagine putting anything in front of it, right? So this park has bridges, has houses, has also this tower, which is made out of hair. I wanted something like more kinetic. And this is... I have to go back. Oh, sorry. This is one of the last works which took me 4 years to build. This is one piece of marble. It's 9 meters... 25. Do you know meters or what is it, 27 feet, 28 feet, something like that. It's one piece of marble, 2 meters by 2 meters. Okay, and you can get what is interesting is that you can actually get this from Carrara, from inside the mountain. You can bring it down to the valley, to Pietrasanta, and you can work. Being able to get such a big piece of marble, you better do something good. I mean, try to make the best out of it. So what I did is I emptied from the inside. Okay, it was 120 tons to begin with, but you see, they had to start with a door, okay, and go inside the stone. And empty everything and throw everything out of the door, which was like 100 tons went out of the door, and they were like inside the stone. Three generations were in that, digging this piece of marble, and then now it's in a collection outside of Brussels. Okay. Yeah, so now I want to talk a little bit about sculpture, if you want. Growing up in this mountain, In this village in Sent, in the Engadine, we have like 5 months out of the year is snow. And when the snow melts, the mountains are gray. So you're like actually very, very, you have these two colors. And of course, like growing up there, your eyes become sensitive to that. If you are in India or you're born in Brazil, of course, my work would be much more colorful. But coming from this region, it's actually just like grays and whites. That's already enough. And my favorite material in sculpture has been from the very beginning plaster. Because not only of the color, which is so close to snow, but also the consistency. I mean, it's also material you have to work fast. And for a very short time, plaster has the same consistency as snow. So I throw this at the wall. This is an installation in Paris. I also did one installation at the V&A once, where you just throw snowballs at the wall in plaster. Oh. And these are the mountains that I see from my window, which was done in 2001. It took me a long time to realize. You know, we always look too far when we do sculpture. It's always like, oh, you want to do this and that. And actually, what is right in front of you, that the obvious, what you're more familiar to, takes sometimes more time to do it. And these are the mountains that I see from my window in Switzerland, and they're also in plaster. Another thing is, if you grew up in the mountains, I always go back now to my youth, which is kind of like probably when you're 2 or 3 years old, everything is already done, right? I mean, the way you look at things, the sensitivity to color. And also this, I realized much later, that by going back to my town, where people sit on their benches, old people sit in front of their houses, and they always look up. It's not like in Italy or in Greece, where the old people sit in front of their houses and they spit to the ground and you look down. They look always up. And that is for me also, like, if I have to concentrate on something, it has to be at 3.30 meters. That's like the way I can concentrate better. And so in New York, it was like not important of the light, or like I had to get like a loft, which was 3.30 meters, which I just sold the other day after 33 years. So this is like a me becoming a donkey, the transformation of me becoming an animal, becoming a donkey. This is called Greyhound Carrying My Broken Leg. I did break my leg when I was 14 years old. I went too fast, skied too fast. I'm such a bad skier. Well, I skied too fast, broke my leg, and then put this on the Greyhound, because this piece has to do with speed. Okay, the dog doesn't have even feet, I can see now. And this shows like my fraction. It was like a nightmare, it was horrible. So I had to, later on, to do this in order to get rid of it. This is one pig walking on two, also in plaster. And this is another material which I very much like, is white marble. This piece is called Sitting on My Face. And also, like again, like 3.20 meters. It's always the same measurement. It's always like 3.20 meters. That's like, if I have to concentrate on this, I mean, I could not sit on my face at 3.25 meters, but like otherwise, after it was done and I had to change something, it's up there. This is a sled, which goes which doesn't work because it goes in all directions. Also carved out of one piece of marble. There are many people who lived in the Engadine. This valley attracted so many people because of its beauty, which I said before, but also people are always saying how great the Engadine is. Also the English, they love to come to St. Moritz and to the Crystal Run. And they actually invented, English people invented the winter sports. I mean, people from there would not climb a mountain or go skiing, or like, but like the English came, and then they started in like 1850 to do sports. And also Nietzsche wrote Zarathustra there. It still attracts lots of people like Richter, and you always see artists like Schnabel. They're always attracted to these valleys. So like, when I was little, we used to go to this house in Sils. I don't know if you know, that's like up in the Upper Engadine, and that's where Nietzsche lived. He rented this room for I don't know, 3 or 4 years. He paid 1 Swiss franc for it, and when I was very a little boy, I could only see like his mustache on like on my eye level. All what I could see was his schnauz, no, because he's like, he had so much, such a mustache. At the end, you couldn't even see his mouth. It was almost like a radio talking or something. So like, it was like always his mustache. And so later on, I made like this Nietzsche mustache. And it's actually in his bed, okay? It's like the base for it is the bed, his bed. My father was a hunter, and there were antlers everywhere in the house. And especially this one, which was at the entrance, I don't know exactly where it was. I gave myself one day half a minute, or even less, to write something on it. It has on one side 4 points, on the other side it has 3 points. So like three and four. So I wrote "fuck you," which probably also the deer said to my father before he was killed. When I was studying in Paris, and I really didn't study almost nothing. I mean, it was like I went to Paris in '68, in April '68. The air was so thick. I mean, because like everyone was preparing for May '68, and I was in this university in Vincennes. So it was like, There were 13 left-wing groups, Marxists. There were like, I think, 4 Marxist groups and Leninists, Trotskyists. And this was like, this is what went on at that time. The only thing we really learned is to throw stones and running from the police. But it was this girl, I think she was from Turkey, and she was like, she was doing research, and she spent a lot of time at that time thinking what materials have not been used in art, which I found like a completely kind of like ridiculous. No, I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, the other people are doing the revolution, and she came out and no one had used soap at the time. So like, so I don't know if she did a sculpture in soap, but it's kind of like thinking of that time. I thought I should do a soap sculpture, and because like this is my studio in Beijing, and you have all these very prolific, great assistants, and you constantly have to give work again, you know, just like this workers in Africa, you constantly have to build something. So in China, you know, it goes like it's constant activity. And so I said, okay, let's make a piece out of soap. And this was shown in Brussels. And it's called 625. The reason why it's 625, because we also counted how many points this sculpture has. Now you have like what I've been working for a long time, especially in the 80s, were juxtapositions. Try to put two things together which has nothing to do, okay? Like, let's say, take a ear and put that together with something, which has nothing to do, okay? which is not easy, you know, because if you put an ear to sausage, could be the ear could be in the sausage and so on. So in this thing, this here is like what you have here, also kind of like a juxtaposition, because it could be a stone, right, which is very hard, but then you have the softness of the soul. So like, if you put these two together, sometimes you create something which has tension. It could be you create something could be maybe funny at times. Or you can also, if you're lucky, create something which is interesting, no? Which means nothing, actually. Interesting. When I was in Italy in the 80s, 85, I was living above a butcher shop. And one day I went to the foundry and I saw that they had like these tongues like in the window, right? So just took one, went to the foundry and had that cast in bronze. And this has been like since 1985, always kind of like the threat through the work. And the reason why it's like that is because as a sculptor, you know, you measure in meters, you measure in inches and whatever, like feet. But like, I think that you have to have your own measurement. You have to create your own measurement. Something which is only yours. And if you have like this tongue here, which is 39 centimeters or 37, and you have this one, which is 5'8". It's exactly as high as the David of Michelangelo. It's not easy. It's not just like you just don't enlarge. It's like a completely new sculpture because you have to make it much longer. You have to make it much. You have to change it in order, which is that the work turns out right. Did you understand that? I don't know if I did understand that, but it's something that is very important, I think, that to have this own measurement. Because actually, big is nothing else than small enlarged. But in this case, it becomes a different sculpture. And I've done even tongues which are taller. There's one which is like 10 meters, no, not 10, but 7 meters 80 and so on. This one was just shown in Paris. And it's a cow tongue. And again, back to plaster, this is back in Beijing. It's this sculpture which is called Hanging and Waiting. First it was called Hanging and Waiting. Because like whenever you put something on the wall, you have to wait about 5 minutes. If it doesn't fall off, it's fine, right? I mean, you hang something, you wait a minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, and it's fine. Then I remember in New York, I was sleeping under a sculpture for about 5 years. It was like on a nail which was crooked. It was very heavy. I mean, it could have killed me anytime, you know, but I felt like you sleep better under a condition like that. So this is like Hanging and Waiting. It's a piece in white in plaster, and there is a whole group of these pieces now. This is also shown in Brussels. And it's this tension again. I mean, it's hanging. There's others. They're just hanging barely. Like it's almost like they're falling off. You know, I mean, to have this kind of like this piece that hangs there, and it's made out of plaster. Would it be made out of stainless steel? That's a completely different thing. Now you see, it's actually stainless steel and plaster combined. I like to combine materials like. As you can see, there are all kinds of different materials. I just made the golden calf, and that. So, and the reason why I like to use different materials and not like use, I don't know, steel like Richard Serra or this, like, is because like most probably has to do with having to deal with languages, because like my mother language, I could only speak 10% out of my life. If you go 10 minutes this way, they speak Italian, so you have to speak Italian. You go the other way, 20 minutes, they speak German, so you have to speak German. So like at high school, we had 7 languages, and like to deal with all these languages has probably also to do that later on, my work at least, I start like working with different materials and not just stick to one material. And this is, in Chinese, zhe means a mole, okay? And so this is called Mao Zedong. It's not Mao Zedong, but it's Mao Zedong, meaning Mao with a mole, because he's got this big mole here, no? So like, I did like this piece in charcoal. It was also shown in, this is shown in Berlin, but I also showed this in China, where you have to be a little bit careful because you cannot say anything about Mao, okay? You can write it in English, but make sure it's not written in Chinese, because, like, you know, if you have to have the next visa, they might, like, you might not get it, maybe. And this is Pete Snyder. This is a mountain made out of coal. I really like that material. It's great. I mean, I don't know who, again, used coal, but, like, this is Pete Snyder, which is a mountain above St. Moritz, which is very famous. So, and then, as I told you, I just started painting less than 2 years ago, and it happened really. I always had an interest in painting, but I really didn't know, first of all, what to paint or how to paint. I was not trained as a painter, and it just happened in China, because you have like so much time, you have all these assistants, and so like I went out, bought canvas, and made a portrait. Made a portrait of myself being a rice farmer. The great thing about painting, which has nothing actually to do with sculpture, is that you can do you can do whatever you want. I mean, you can be like the rice farmer, you can be like a criminal, you can be anything. And also, like, doing sculpture all the time, you constantly have to deal with reality. It's exactly what it is, you know. That's what Baudelaire once said, it's sculpture is boring because you have always to go around to look at, right? So here you don't have. You're just like a frontal view. You can be, this is my assistant, Tintian. And this is my Tai Chi teacher. So, like, people who are in the studio, I paint. And they're in canvas, and they're very small. They're, like, small, yeah, about the right size so that you can carry around. And this is also a self-portrait with Alzheimer's. This is probably what would have happened if I ever get Alzheimer's. So, like, you can put yourself also in a position in the future. And that's it.